Started then. We'll start with the introductions and welcome. So welcome everybody. This is the Council Affairs Committee on September 9th. There we go. I'm Chuck Adams, one of the co-chairs. Helen.
Hi,
Say hello.
Helen, committee member.
Everybody's moving around. There we go. Nah.
Nolly, council member.
Irma.
Irma Parada, council co-chair.
TJ.
TJ Lee Miyake, he, him, committee member.
Marco.
Hey, good afternoon, everyone. Marco Montenegro, council member.
Anna.
Anna Brenzuela,
Anna, there we go.
council member.
Elise.
Hi, everyone. Elise Griffin, council member.
Did I miss anybody? All right, we'll start with the staff then. Kat.
Kat Pudge-Gear, council staff.
Kira, there we go.
Kira, council staff.
Mark just left, right?
I see a Thomas iPhone. Mark Molnar, council staff. I see a Thomas iPhone and a Bill just joining, so I guess you have two more people to call.
All right. So, Thomas, say hello.
Hello.
And Bill can say hello. And John.
Hi. Good afternoon. This is Bill, HIV Health Service.
And then, who am I missing? Is it RP? Okay, cool. All
Hi,
right,
yes.
Then
good afternoon.
We're going to start with reviewing and approve the September 9th draft agenda. There we go. Quite a large font.
Does that look good with everyone?
It's mine shows a really large font.
I can zoom out. Is that better?
Okay, there you go.
All right, how does this look to folks?
I think it's perfect.
I will move on to the minutes then.
There we go. Any
I think Chuck might be cutting out, right?
Yeah, I was cutting in and out. There
oh.
we go. So we'll approve that by consensus. Then we'll move on to the minutes for August 12th. Anybody sees any changes, let us know. If not, we'll accept these by consensus also. All right, and so now we'll move on to announcements. Does anyone have an announcement? I don't see any hands up. Okay, Mark.
Sorry, eating. Has everyone turned in their prioritization worksheets? Everyone? Okay, for those of you who did not nod your head yes, please do send me your prioritization worksheet.
I haven't sent it, but I'm going to send it by then.
Excellent, excellent. Great. Thank you.
All right. I don't see any public, so we don't need any public comment. Oh, then we're ready for the HIV EPI report. That was RP, right?
That's RP. And just, I don't know, RP, first of all, pleased to meet you. I don't know if we've actually met before. You've been communicating with my team and I. If this is not your first time doing this, then forgive me. But if it is your first time, there's no need to go in depth about each slide. I know this is a long presentation. And you can do very good. I'm glad you're relieved of that. And just do like a, you know, quick rundown, just so that we can keep within our time. And plus, you'll get to be doing that in front of the full council anyway.
Thank you for those introductory comments. This is my first time. It is nice to meet you in person as well, or virtually, as well as everyone else. And I have my slides up, and I am they're very data heavy, and I'm trying to your comment will help me kind of just give a higher level summary of the slides. So I'm going to share my screen if that's okay. Let's see here. What's this screen do? Okay. Here. So when I do this, you disappear on me. Why is that? Okay. So thank you, everyone. It's a pleasure and privilege to present to you. My name is RP Terzian. I go by she, her pronouns. I'm the director of HIV Epidemiology and Surveillance Unit at the San Francisco Department of Public Health. This is my first year of the position, and it's great to present to you. We'll be presenting, here's an outline. You can see my screen, right? But
no.
No. No. If you share screen and then we disappear, you know, we can hold our questions or comments to the end, or if people just want to like sort of say them out loud, if you can't see us, that might be one way to do it. Also want to mention for the recording that Jan Oskarsson has joined us. Hello, Jan.
Hello, everybody. Oh. I'm super sorry I'm late.
Okay. So I see a blue, so you don't see the outline right now.
No. Let's see.
Kat or Kira, would it be helpful if I sent it to you?
Yeah, we have your, I think the previous one, I can throw up that one, or if you want to send over the most recent.
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. Thank you.
Thank you, Kira, for sharing on your end. Appreciate you. And while we're waiting for that to come up, RP, you did receive hopefully the agenda that I created in advance. So you have where you fall under the full council agenda. Hopefully that's enough time. Let me know if you have any questions.
Okay. I'll start off until, Kira, I just sent it to you and okay. I apologize for the delay. I'll just continue without a screen until Kira can share the slides on her end. Thank you so much. Okay, so I have three sections to the outline, which include purpose and scope of work for the HIV surveillance unit. Then I'll go right into HIV trends observed in the past year and how they fit in with the past, say, 10 years, and focus on populations of interest. Then the third section is just wrapping up and summarizing and see where we're going from there. I give a little background on what is surveillance, and it's the, I provide a definition, the ongoing systematic collection, analysis, interpretation, and dissemination of HIV surveillance. Thank you, yay! Advance to the next slide, please.
Okay, this is the previous one that you did send us, so because I haven't gotten the new one, but once I get it, I can throw that one up.
Okay. Thank you. How awkward. Okay, yes, please. You can advance to the purpose of HIV. Thank you. The purpose of surveillance is to monitor trends, report on care and treatment outcomes, and detect outbreaks. We serve the purpose to provide a comprehensive picture of the SF or the HIV epidemic in San Francisco. Our data helps serve to inform resource allocation and support delivery of prevention and health service activities, and support local initiatives and federal as well, such as getting to zero and ending the epidemic. Next slide. This is, I wanted to share how surveillance is a essential component of the CDC's public health services framework. We fit into the red slices of the pie here, and that includes assessment, where we monitor and report on the health status of those being diagnosed or at risk for HIV, and care and treatment outcomes in those living with HIV in San Francisco.
All right, I got the new one, so I'll throw that one up and try to find the place.
Oh, yay! Thank you.
Give me 1 second. All right, and you were here, correct?
Yes, thank you. Then I briefly go into scope of work, where our scope of work aims to minimize new infections, maximize access to care, and reduce health disparities. I talk about the data systems that we use to inform the work we do. The National HIV Surveillance System, which is the second row boxes, are our primary source of data, and we use it to understand diagnoses, understand treatment, understand prevention and response. And there are additional supporting or supplemental data sources that coordinate in this beautiful orchestra where we conduct our work. Thank you. Next slide. Okay, we can skip this. Yeah, thank you. I'm a visual person. I like this infographic. It's intended to show the data impact of CDC's data systems, but I think it also applies to our city HIV surveillance data system, to show that the data that we use we're in collaboration and in community with all these different entities, including advocacy organizations, federal agencies, HUD, HRSA, CDC, community-based organizations, other local and state health departments, research and academic organizations. So very wide-reaching. Thank you. And a note of where we fit in operationally in the organization. We fall under ARCHES, the Applied Research Community Health and Epidemiology and Surveillance program, and there's different units underneath that: viral hepatitis, STIs, and we fall under the HIV surveillance epidemiology and surveillance unit. We're a small and mighty team. We lost 7 members due to budget cuts and retirement as of the end of May, a couple months ago, and I'm very impressed with the team rolling with the punches that we've had recently. Thank you. Next slide. Thank you. Next slide. I'll go into HIV trends and populations of interest. This is our bread and butter slide where we report the number of new HIV diagnoses, the number of deaths reported in 2024. I'll start with the red bar. The story here is in 2024, we reported 146 new diagnoses of HIV in San Francisco. That's a slight increase from 140 in 2023. That corresponds to about a little over 4% increase. The green line represents the number of deaths. We do not have death data for 2024 is currently incomplete due to reporting lags and interruptions at the federal level. But we do have data for 2023, and we report 308 deaths among those with HIV in San Francisco. The number of deaths have exceeded the number of new diagnoses, so the inflection point since 2017. Thank you. Next slide. We monitor overall citywide trends as well as populations of interest that include groups at higher risk for experiencing HIV-related disparities. These include gay and bisexual and other men who have sex with men, MSM, transgender persons, Black African Americans, Latinx, people experiencing homelessness, people who use drugs, people who inject drugs. And I pulled some of this from a lot of this I'd like to give credit to the San Francisco's Integrated ETE Plan 2024-2026. Thank you. Next slide. Kira, you're great. Thank you so much. All right, I'm jumping into trends among MSM. In 2024, MSM transmission risk accounts for 62% of all new diagnoses in San Francisco. Overall, this is a slide showing the past 10 years and the overall proportion attributed to MSM transmission risk has declined since 2015. The next group is MSM slash, or not slash, dash PWID. So the majority of cases are MSM transmission risk. And that has been the case for quite a while. So no change in that trend. Thank you. Next slide. If we look at all persons with HIV in San Francisco, MSM transmission risk accounts for 74% as of the end of 2024 in San Francisco. And I pulled it from our HIV annual report, which is scheduled, I should have mentioned this disclaimer, scheduled to be posted online and released publicly in 10 days, September 19th. Thank you. Next slide. And Mark, if this is too detailed, I can go a little faster. Feel free
Oh, I
to.
think, yeah, I think we have time. Are you about halfway through? Oh no, 6 of 29. Yeah, you can go a little faster. How's that?
Okay. The next three slides, two or three slides, are about HIV trends in trans women. In 2024, 6% of all new HIV diagnoses were among trans women. New HIV diagnoses disproportionately affect trans women. 6%, and that equates to roughly 9 persons in 2024, down from 11. If you see this line, there is, if you look at the time trend, overall, the proportion of new diagnoses among trans women are going up. Next slide. This group is more likely to be Latinx and Black African American. So people of color are disproportionately affected by HIV in this group. Next slide. Then I go into an emerging trend that we observed among cis women. Next slide. In 2024, new diagnoses among cis women nearly doubled in the past year, from 14 diagnoses in 2023 to 26 diagnoses in 2024. So last year, new diagnoses among cis women represented 10%, and then they jumped to 18% this year. A concerning uptick. Next slide. By transmission risk, most of them, I'll say, sorry, over half of new diagnoses among cis women have reported or presumed heterosexual risk. Next slide. Uh, 46% of the new diagnoses among cis women were Black African American, so almost half. Then that followed by cis women who are white, and then cis women who are Latinx. The majority of, yeah, so over almost half were Black African American. I'll just leave it there. Next slide. And this slide is a great infographic that others have asked me to replicate for other populations, and we're working on that. This is just to show that cis women with HIV, and people who were, that this group is disproportionately affected by HIV, especially if you consider the underlying female population in San Francisco. So for example, Black African Americans in San Francisco, females represent only 5% of the overall San Francisco population, but among those with HIV, they represent 35% of the population. Thank you, next slide. So then I go into trends by race, ethnicity, and we're going to skip through a few of these slides because I did so much jujitsu that I reordered, and they're there, but they're not in the correct order. Long story short, persons of color disproportionately affected by HIV. And they're in those slides. Then I jump into HIV trends by age. It's an aging epidemic. 3/4 of those persons with HIV in San Francisco are age 50 or older in 2024. Thank you. And the proportion of new diagnoses among persons age 50 and older in San Francisco is declining since 2021. In 2024, for example, about 15% of new diagnoses were among persons aged 50 or over. Even though we see this declining, somewhat of a declining trend here, it is still higher than what we observed in 2015, about 10 years ago, when it was only 10% of new diagnoses. Thank you. Next slide. So new HIV diagnoses disproportionately affect persons aged 30 to 39. That's the group that's most hit by HIV. And that trend has not changed in the past 10 years. The orange bar, a line. And then the next group is sort of the 40 to 49 age group. Increased risk of an HIV diagnosis. Next slide. I go summarize by housing status. Next slide, thank you. Proportion of new diagnoses among persons experiencing homelessness is increasing. So this line, the orange line, is kind of jumping around in the covers from 2015 to 2024. In 2024, we observed 16% of new diagnoses were among persons experiencing homelessness. And the year before that, 2023, was 23%. And then it goes down to 17%. Not exactly sure what's happening right here, but this is what we observe. And overall, as time is going by, the proportion of is increasing since 2015. Thank you. Next slide. And some characteristics of those new diagnoses. So newly diagnosed cis women, persons who are Black, African American, and white, persons who inject drugs, and persons who inject drugs and have MSM transmission risk are all more likely to experience homelessness. And this is aggregated across 10 years. Thank you, next slide. Okay, next slide, we'll talk about mortality trends. As I mentioned, our data, the most recent available or data that's available to us goes up to 2023. There are reporting lags for 2024. When we do our death match with various, the National Death Index and other Social Security Death Master File, fatal overdose and heart disease are the top underlying causes of death. And here we present three columns. These three columns represent years 2012 to 2023. And the last column represents just the last 24 years, 2020 to 2023. The heart disease include coronary heart disease, cardiomyopathy, and then the third grouping or classification for underlying causes of death are non-AIDS cancer, such as lung cancer, anorectal cancer, liver cancer. Thank you. Next slide. Okay, this is a slide that a lot of people had some issues with, and I think because there's a lot going on here. This slide represents age-adjusted mortality rates among people aged 18 and over with HIV per 100,000, and from 2014 to 2023. If you ignore the dotted orange line for now, we'll circle back to that. The green solid line is going up over time, increasing, and that is the mortality rate among adults with HIV are higher among Black, African American cis men. That seems to be a steady increase since around 5 years ago. The next group that have higher age-adjusted mortality rates are white cis men, represented in the yellow solid line. Okay, now I'm gonna scoot back and do the orange dotted line. These are trans women. These rates are not age adjusted. It's you can see that it's jumping around, and that's because due to small numbers, the estimates are more uncertain and show more variability. But certainly that is a group that also is experiencing higher mortality rate. Thank you, next slide. Okay, trends in care and treatment outcomes. Next slide, please. This includes diagnosis, linkage to care within 1 month of diagnosis, retention and care, and viral suppression. All steps in the care continuum. This is a very dense slide caveat. I am working with others to clean it up, to make it more user or visually friendly, consumer friendly. Okay. In 2020, we do not have all the data due to reporting lags for all the care and treatment outcomes in 2024. We just have new diagnoses and linkage to care within 1 month. So I'm going to start with the 2023 data. We have those estimates represented in the orange bar. Ignore all the other colors. Just focus on the orange bar. 90 of those newly diagnosed in 2023, 94% of them, so that's the second grouping, were linked to care within 1 month of diagnosis. That's amazing. Okay, jump following that group and jumping into retention and care, this is what proportion of that group were retained in care for 3 to 9 months after being linked to care. And then that goes to 76%. And then among that group, how many are virally suppressed within 6 months and 12 months among all diagnoses? And so the 9 months are represented on the orange bar that is like shaded. And then you see the little solid orange at the top, that's for 12 months. I gotta clean this up here. But long story short, 87% of new diagnoses in 2023 achieved viral suppression within 12 months. Hi, Mark. Am I? Yes. No. Okay. Sorry.
Sorry. I didn't say anything, but that might have been my computer going off. I'll mute.
Okay. For 2024, the data have not all come in, so we're not exact. We do not have data for viral suppression within 12 months among all diagnoses. So that would be someone who was diagnosed on, you know, December 31st, 2024. We would need data that have not come in yet. It's in the future. But they are. So far, we know that within 6 months, 79% of all new diagnoses were virally suppressed. We have some work to do. Thank you. Next slide. Oh, this is, I'm so sorry. This, skip this. This is the, this is, it should have been earlier. Should have been earlier. Oh, here we go. Let's keep with the care. Nearly three quarters of those of persons with HIV were virally suppressed in 2024. This is not just among new diagnoses, but everyone who were last known to reside in San Francisco as of December 31st, 2024, regardless of where they were diagnosed. So that includes persons who were diagnosed, who were residents of San Francisco and were diagnosed with HIV, and those who may have been diagnosed with HIV outside of our jurisdiction but moved to San Francisco. The latter group is about 3,100. First group is about 8,300, totaling to about 11,357. We have work to do. I just jumped to the last outcome in viral suppression in the interest of time. And I hope that my skipping through some things is not meant to not showcase the severity and the challenges that we're facing. I do not mean to come across as cavalier. Thank you. Next slide. Okay, median time from diagnosis to viral suppression improved over time, but it varied by characteristics. Overall, top left quadrant, you see that blue line, on average, not on average, the median time is generally around 40 days to get to achieve from diagnosis to viral suppression. this time, meeting time goes up for those who are Black, African American, homeless, and persons who inject drugs. However, we do not have 2024 data for this yet, but we do see some improvements among those who are homeless. If you look at 2023, bottom right quadrant, you see the green line go down. And similarly, bottom left quadrant, that red line goes down sharply at 2023. Oh, and that means that it's less than, or reaching at least the citywide median time from diagnosis viral suppression. Thank you. Next slide. Persons with injection drug persons who inject drugs, the takeaway, less likely to achieve care and treatment outcomes in general. This is not very visible, but in that red circle, you'll see that the numbers there are all lower than their counterparts who are MSM or heterosexual by transmission risk. Thank you. Next slide. Okay, in summary, we do observe meaningful steady declines in new HIV diagnoses over time, despite the slight increase in new diagnoses reported in 2024. Remember, we went from 140 in 2023 to 146 diagnoses in 2023 to 146 case diagnoses in 2024. New diagnoses disparities continue to exist with in communities of color. New diagnoses increased among Black African Americans, for example, Latinx populations, cis women, and persons aged 30 to 39. So we don't like that, so I put a red light, red colored arrow. The proportion of new diagnoses among those 50 and older have been declined, so that's good. And then we observed increased linkages to care and viral suppression among persons with HIV over time. But we still have work to do for certain groups. And that's the balancing act, that the nuance to messaging. Overall, okay, but we still have work to do. Thank you, next slide. And that might be it. Oh, ignore this, I'm still reviewing this. This is not quite ready, I think. Thank you. Shout out to the link to our annual report, which will be available September 19th at this URL. And then thank you, next slide. I'd like to thank my colleagues in the HIV unit, as well as the ARCHES staff, colleagues in our various, in HIV, STI, CHEP, Bridge HIV, CPHR, the STI HIV Prevention Branch, SF AIDS Foundation. I do have some slides on PrEP and can share if there's time. And then people with HIV, HIV healthcare providers, the community groups, researchers, and members of the community. Thank you. I welcome feedback and questions.
Anybody have questions?
I have my hand up. I just didn't want to jump in.
I just can't see it. Okay, there it is. Okay.
So thank you very much for that presentation. That was really great. There was a lot of incredible information in there. I was just wondering if we could go back, to slide, I think it was 34 out of the 50 slides. It was the one about mortality over 100,000 people, the one that you thought people might have a little bit of concern about. I was just curious, like, is there any, do we know, are there any specific variables that stick out for these people in the African-American community? Is it people over 50 that are dying at a higher rate? Is it just across the board with African Americans dying across the board. I'm just wondering if it's like the baby boomer increase in the aging population. Is that why we're seeing a possible jump?
That is a great question. I don't have the answer off the top of my head, but if we I don't know if we've done sub-analyses, but like if me I do have a draft copy of the report, which may include stratified analyses that would answer that question. So maybe I could put it in the chat box if I find it in the report. I suspect not, but we might have that information.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you. I see Thomas's hand is up. Hey, Thomas.
Thanks. Hey there. Good to see you. TJ, I don't take me at my word with this, but I definitely think the overdose for the same population was something that we have seen. And so I know the department specifically with some of its overdose prevention activities in the last 12 months has been focused specifically on older African Americans. So, and since they represent such a small portion of the city, it's definitely concerning. But that would be my first guess. And I kind of noticed in the slides, RP, with the heart disease and overdose, I think you kind of noted were two of the larger things that were causing mortality. So
Thanks,
that's it.
Thomas.
Thank you, TJ and Thomas.
Anyone else?
If there are no other questions, I just kind of want to acknowledge the trauma, for lack of a better word, that our Arches team has been through. In the last few years, between retirement, kind of coming out of COVID, and then what's going on in public health as a whole, it's been bam, 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 bam. So, RP, I appreciate the fact that the data is still rolling and coming, and that the team is showing up and still pulling it together. I do feel like the HIV data.
Oh, you're on mute, Thomas. Can you unmute? Thank you.
That is so disappointing because what I said was really quite cool. And one of those moments where you're like, oh, I impressed myself. Sorry about that. But I just wanted to acknowledge that they did it mute all the way through? Did you hear anything of what I said?
Just
We
at
heard
the end
different.
of muted, I did hear some. Thank you.
Oh, just acknowledging that the department's been through a lot and you all have been really good at between COVID, retirements. What's going on at a federal level? There has just been multiple hits to public health, and Epi folks have definitely taken a very significant blow, and that you all have managed to navigate those waters and keep the data flowing. So thank you.
Thank you for acknowledging that. Yeah. We lost most of our field surveillance due to funding terminations or funding cuts. So we tried to transition as much as we could from active surveillance to passive surveillance. So we're doing less site field visits to collect data, for example.
All right. Well,
I'm
thank you for
sorry.
your
Can you
presentation.
guys hear me? This is Bill.
Oh yeah, go ahead.
Hi, Bill.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Hi, I'm having troubles with this particular call-in. So, RB, a few suggestions to consider. One, when you start the presentation, to share that this is citywide data as opposed to people that are clients of DPH. So, this is kind of showing the whole range, and it's about a little over double the number. So, a little less than half or touch at least a DPH funded service. It's because people have been used to looking at data sets from ARES and now HIV Care Connect. It sounds like maybe your PowerPoint is in process. I think like maybe slide 4 or 5, you show about you have the slide with the death rate kind of intersecting with the new infection rate. Maybe consider connecting that slide where you do the deep dive into the death rate, which I think will be interesting to people. I think I think they pair well together. You may also want, to the extent possible, kind of highlight what we think is HIV related, or at least related versus causal versus not. So just to help people show the difference. When you talk about the African-American women going with new infections, going from 2 to 4, maybe just a little bit of feedback statistically, when you have such a small N, what does it mean to go from 2 to 4 or 4 to 6? Actually, it was 4 to 6. That might be helpful to provide some additional context there. Oh, and I guess the last comment was, when you were talking about women in HIV, I think what you meant to say was that African-American women represent over a third of the women living with HIV, as opposed to a third of the people living with HIV. So maybe just when you do that slide, make sure to call it out in that way so it's clear to people.
Thank you. I have a question for the group. I've received some feedback, and it seems like there are two groups where one group wants to see new diagnoses presented first in one section, whereas other folks want to view the data by populations of interest, whether it's MSM or Black African Americans. I kept switching it. Do you think that it works the way it is, or do you think I should just reorder them so that I just talk about what's happening among new diagnoses, trends in new diagnoses first, and then talk about the overall trends observed in the prevalent or persons with HIV in San Francisco?
I think it makes most sense to talk about the trends as a whole. And then when you discuss the new cases, it's almost like you're zooming in on a specific subset. So I think the story might just flow a little bit more seamless if you talk about, all cases, and then you talk about new cases.
Thank you.
Jan, did you have a question?
Oh, I was gonna say exactly what Elise was saying, because then you sort of like give a sort of like the state of the state, and then you zoom in on a new diagnosis, and with those, like, if there are parallel trends which you see in sort of both the overall picture and then in the new diagnosis, then those can sort of likely be highlighted, but you wouldn't necessarily have to go through that, on both sides.
Thank you. Yeah.
Okay, anyone else? If not, thank you so much for your presentation, and we'll see you in the last Monday.
Great, thank you.
All right, next is the needs assessment. Oh, Mark, go ahead. Did you raise your hand?
I was waving goodbye.
Oh, okay. Next, we have Kira with the needs assessment report.
Yeah, and I will share that. So I do want to warn everyone, this still is a work in progress, but I did want to kind of get some overall themes in here. So please let me know if you have any questions. All right, so this year's needs assessment target population was people living with HIV over 65 years. And this is a little bit of our overview. We'll first go over some background. I'll include some data snapshots. Then we'll go over our findings. The conclusion isn't filled out yet, but there will be a conclusion. And then we will work on the recommendations. And at the end, there will be a Q&A, but feel free to jump in right now if anyone has any questions as I go through these. All right, so our background and methodology. Here I included some background information, including when the outreach took place, which was from March of this year to through this month. And then, of course, those outreach efforts were led by both myself and Kat. And then we had a total of 54 participants in our needs assessment this year, which is really exciting.
And those participants were incentivized with a $50 Safeway gift card. I also included some of the organizations that we worked with in order to outreach to these participants. All right, and then beginning our data snapshot, the first one is, what is your age? So you can kind of see there, a majority of our participants were 66 to 70. And the next one was, how many years have you been living with HIV? And a majority of our participants have been living with HIV for more than 30 years. This was a question unique to this survey. And so we asked folks what modes of transportation they typically use to get to appointments. And this was a check all that applies kind of questions. So although a majority of participants did say that they mostly use the city bus, that was sometimes supplemented with also walking or also using the taxi. And then there is this other section at the very bottom that we got a lot of participants clicking. And most of those participants that clicked that other box did write in that they used their own car to drive themselves to appointments. I think there was one or two participants that wrote in that they use either an electric scooter or a bike. All right, this was another unique question to this survey specifically. And it was, how many different medications are you currently taking? And so it's kind of a wide range here. We have participants stating that they took as little as 3, all the way to as many as 19. So really a wide range. A lot of people fell into that 8 category, but really varied. All right, and then we did ask folks how they typically purchase their groceries. And this was also a check all that applies question. So a majority of folks did say that they shopped in person, but we also did find that folks that would click this option would also sometimes click other options such as food support agency. So they kind of supplemented their own groceries with also going to a food support agency. All right, and this was our service category ranking. And so during this portion is when we asked participants to look at the service categories and rank them most important, from least important to most important for themselves. And so the most highly ranked category was primary medical care, followed by mental health services and food. And dental care, I actually looked at the, I think one of the most recent surveys that we did was for 50 plus, and dental care was actually, I think, the second most highly ranked, so it kind of fell down a little bit, and it was switched out with mental health services. So I thought that was very interesting. All right, moving on to our findings. A lot of discussion was had over primary medical care, and a lot of concerns that were repeated time after time to us were over the fear of losing medical coverage, actually. And that was just due to the current climate we're in. So folks feeling that they may have to think about whether or not their HIV meds would be covered and what they would do if that were to happen. Also losing knowledgeable doctors and the effect that it would have on their quality of life, especially when they think about their issues not getting resolved and then kind of snowballing into bigger issues. Folks also mentioned that their appointments sometimes felt like a revolving door, so that their doctors just kind of wanted to get them in and out. And so not really getting listened to was a big concern. Some other concerns surrounding this was also medication overload. So as you saw in that previous, in one of the snapshots, there was quite a big range of folks stating that they had as little as 3 medications to take to as many as 19. So when you think about that, that was clearly top of mind for folks when thinking about the long-term consequences of using that many meds or using them for that long. And funny enough, on the other hand, we also had folks that when they thought about this, they also were kind of just an acceptance of this long-term use of medications. They knew they needed it, and so they kind of just had accepted it and said, well, yeah, it's just another thing I do. Some praise was to be said regarding folks relationship with their primary care provider. A lot of folks really saw it as beneficial and valuable as they saw their primary care providers as HIV experts. They really felt like they had a partnership with them and they had built up this rapport. So you can see how that could be concerning when they think about the long term of either their doctor retiring or moving on. That was very concerning for them. And there in the bottom, I did include some quotes. So Jazz were the first generation to age with HIV. Did someone have a question?
Yes.
It looks like Elise has their hand raised. I have a question as well, but Elise first, please.
Yeah, you, Carrie, you kind of already answered this, but for the second bullet where it says losing knowledgeable doctors, was that primarily due to retirement, or was it also just, you know, like the doctor has moved on?
Folks didn't really say either or. They were very aware that eventually they would lose their doctor, though. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the kind of conversation that took place, where they knew at some point their doctor would retire, and they didn't know if their doctor would retire before they were able to get, you know, continue getting their care, or their doctor would move on to a different practice.
Thanks.
Mark, you had a question?
Yeah, I mean, also, I do think it, at least this has been a trend for at least a decade now, perhaps longer, the idea of HIV care itself moving more into a managed care of chronic illness, managed care of chronic illness model, combined with retirement. I certainly have heard the retirement wave that started about a decade ago just continue on. I'm actually asking the question before you even got to the quote, but I'm curious about that second quote. Sometimes it feels more like a conversation than a medical screening. Was that a critical comment, or was that a
That was actually like a praise almost.
Oh, good. Yeah, we'll make that clear definitely when you mention it, because I think that's certainly a part of how we train our direct service workers. So it's nice to know that intake workers are doing the same thing.
Yeah, I think going on that quote, sometimes it feels more like a conversation than medical screening. That was in relation to that last bullet point, which is where folks really felt like they had built this relationship, this really good relationship with their PCP. And then the last one being not a long-term survivor, I'm a long-term thriver. Did you have any more questions, Mark?
No.
Okay. All right, I will move on then. All right, and then continuing the service category discussion, there was a lot of discussion regarding mental health care. And so a lot of folks really felt that their mental health care tied into their medical care, and it was just affecting their general quality of life. And that was due to a lot of discussion around medication. So what effects medication had on folks' bodies really affected their mental health. Some folks spoke to certain medications causing them to not be able to go out as much or not be able to enjoy the activities that they usually do. And so that in turn really affected them and their well-being, as they could no longer do those activities or they couldn't be as social as they once were. Another point that was brought up that we'll discuss a little bit later as well is the re-traumatization from early days when there was grief from losing loved ones. And so that was a big topic of conversation, but I won't go into that just quite yet. Some quotes are mentioned here. Never expected to live this long. If I get out once a week, I'm lucky. Another topic of discussion was housing. The feeling that it's not adequate, safe, or supportive. A lot of folks did say they didn't feel stable enough in their housing. Some of that was attributed to the fact that some folks started to feel like it wasn't senior friendly enough. So they really had to take into account if they could go upstairs or if they had mobility challenges, their housing now that they lived in for years maybe was not so adequate for them. A lot of talk around this was also attributed to the affordability of housing and it being almost non-existent. So a lot of folks talked about how they stayed where they were due to the quality of medical care within San Francisco. They were very aware that they were getting really great care in San Francisco. And so they decided, you know what, I'm just gonna put up living here in order to continue getting that care. a lot of folks also talked about the high cost of housing being more than what they make, so they really weren't able to move because of that. They couldn't afford to move, really. Another thing that was mentioned when we discussed housing was the current political climate that was causing anxiety about whether or not a housing subsidy for certain participants would be affected, and then how folks would even be able to handle being able to pay rent or being able to pay for things financially if they didn't have that subsidy. So some quotes that came out of that was, will I have safe housing or will I lose it? If I didn't have this housing, I would be in a tent on Market Street. All right, and I will move on. All right, so some findings during our interview portion. So during this portion, we did ask folks questions regarding aging with HIV, quality of life, and any gaps in their care. So this was a little bit more of a conversation. People shared as much as they liked. So the big topic that came out of this one, one of the big topics was aging with HIV. And so folks were really interested in what support was available to them or how they could prepare. And when thinking about aging with HIV, participants did emphasize worrying about losing their independence. That was a point that was repeated time and time again with different participants that we talked to. It's really important for people, it became clear in that conversation that folks really, really valued their independence. And that kind of is tied into being able to take care of themselves. And then thinking about losing or the lack of access that they might have to long-term care. Also, folks were not aware of the available services, so it was concerning for them to think about aging. Participants also spoke to the feeling of being unprepared for any future complications. So although folks did have their documents in order for end-of-life care, they didn't necessarily know how to handle their health declining or now coming to terms with their body slowing down, things like that. Something that was mentioned that was really important and emphasized was that folks said that they didn't expect to live this long. And so they didn't really have long-term plans and that and they were talking about this financially. So they didn't have long-term savings plans, which is why a lot of folks kind of are concerned now that they're aging because they don't know what they're going to do, especially when they think about the current climate and maybe losing certain benefits. And then some quotes here are, you're never prepared for the bad stuff. I have to take it day by day, and it's hard to feel like I can prepare for the future. As we get older, our needs grow. This continued. Then we did discuss quality of life and how folks felt like they were lowering their standards in order to meet their reality. So participants did speak to the uncertainty of being able to afford housing, food, and living in general. And the overarching theme here that was consistently talked about was not having the means to afford the care that they needed. So a lot of folks expressed feeling like they had to lower their standards in order to be able to afford to live in San Francisco or take care of themselves. And this could be seen in the form of opting for cheaper grocery items. So I think someone, if I remember correctly, somebody said that they used to shop at Rainbow Grocery Store and now they couldn't, so they had to, you know, kind of live within their budget, and that meant now they had to go for the cheaper items or more affordable items for them, and they could no longer shop for the items that they really wanted or used to be able to. And so we can see that because we can also see that in the data snapshot that I presented, some folks shopping for themselves also so that they were supplementing their food with food banks. And some quotes that came out of that were, could be a lot better, but I can eat. If I can't eat and nurture myself, I can't get to the doctor and take care of myself. Another big topic of conversation during this portion was mental health, specifically dealing with the grief from the 80s and 90s and present day. Folks did express that a mental health care was challenging to acquire, especially with only getting certain appointment allotments, the long wait lists, and the turnover of staff. So getting accustomed to one mental health care provider and then having to get accustomed to a new one because there was quick turnover of staff. A big portion of this discussion was also focused on the emotional trauma sustained from the 80s and 90s that is now coming up, especially as folks are aging and then feeling like you're being re-traumatized because now you're having to remember your friends or your loved ones dying, because that's also now taking place as you're getting older. Another point of this was dealing with survivor's guilt. Excuse me. Dealing with survivor's guilt. And so folks felt that kind of also had a hand in it. Again, was stemming from dealing with the grief from the 80s and 90s. All right, and here are some quotes I will add to this. And then we don't have our conclusion quite yet, but it is just summarizing kind of everything that we've seen into a nice little bullet point list so that folks kind of have a good takeaway. And then recommendations. So typically when we conduct our needs assessment, when we come to present it, we do have a couple of recommendations or action items that kind of comes out of this. So today we wanted to ask the Council Affairs Committee to help shape these recommendations based on the information that you've seen here today.
Consider it to be sort of a pop quiz.
Sorry, guys. I know. I was like, if you weren't paying attention, I'm just kidding.
Except in the end, you're not getting tested. You're literally helping us. Looks like TJ has her hand up.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks, Kira. This is a lot of great information. I was just curious, with the number of pills taken each day, did you find out how many of those were actually HIV meds out of the overall number of pills they were taking? I'm just thinking because, the condensing of cocktail treatments where it was five, six, 10 pills a day down to one or two now, are they taking more aging related medications?
We didn't separate that out, and I was actually wondering if it would be helpful to add another snapshot following this, because we did ask folks what ailments or other diagnoses besides HIV they're currently dealing with as well. So I thought that would kind of be kind of a good hand-in-hand snapshot to provide, so folks can see, typically you're not just dealing with HIV, you're also dealing with these other ailments. Would that be beneficial to see?
Yeah, I think it really would be. Thank you.
So, any thoughts for conclusions or, even more importantly, recommendations from what you've just seen?
I have just one comment about it. Sounds like a lot of the relationship with providers is really important. And I know a lot of health departments, we do provider detailing where we're actually talking to providers and making recommendations on some of the things, how they can, impact their patients. So I just think, some of these quotes and things, it's like, I just think making sure that we get this information to those, provide those people are doing that provider detailing and provider education groups or something like that. I think that's really important that you can really have this impact on how they see their healthcare, how they maybe engage in healthcare and really impact their outcomes. So I don't know if that might be something just about education to providers.
Yeah, I feel like I heard a conclusion and a recommendation there. A conclusion potentially around the importance and centrality of the relationship between the provider and the client, sort of like a person, like a version of like personalized care, and the fear around losing that as it moves away from a specialization specialty model. So maybe something around that, Kira. I mean, you and I can talk further, but something just around like the importance of that relationship. And then a recommendation from that around education of providers. Now, what would you particularly frame the education as, Anna?
Well, I'd have to think about that a little bit more. I mean, I think when we talk to providers, when we go out, they are sometimes we're talking about sexual history. We're not specifically talking to the HIV providers. Some of the simple, we give them simple kind of opening questions and something, how to open those conversations. So I'd have to think a little bit more, but sometimes they just need a template on how do I, what are
Do you
something,
think
how to
that?
engage that,
So I know that certainly caseworkers and people who are managing cases are usually provided opportunities to get trained on motivational interviewing. Do you think that would be useful for medical providers as well?
I think so. And I don't know if Jan can give a little bit more perspective from a provider in terms of, how, I know those folks at Ward A6 really had developed really good relationships. I don't know if there's training that they receive.
No, and I was just thinking as you were talking, and what's very clear, sort of, in your summary, Kira, is and I think in some ways it's sort of maybe because of sort of lack of consistent access to mental health care or, persistent therapist or so on, there is a relationship that builds between, a patient and their HOA care provider. And, in this day and age when, productivity is all the rage and so on, it's because I think in some ways the feedback that you're getting is that whatever is happening is actually working for me as a patient and consumer. I value these things. I value having a relationship that doesn't feel like a visit and more as a conversation about things. I feel like somebody cares about me. And I think sort of the articulation of that, when the system and the systems are really trying to sort of boil it down to 10 minutes max is super important, because it's sort of the productivity discussion kind of is counter to what the lived experience of utilizing services actually is. So anyway.
So I guess, what would that recommendation look like? I kind of got a little bit lost in that, to be honest. I'm not saying you lost me, Jan, but I lost the I kind of lost it. I don't know what a recommendation would look like there.
Okay, I'll rephrase. I guess my point is this. What I think we're hearing from the people who participated in this needs assessment is that there is value to the relationship that people develop with their primary care providers. That's one of the findings that's coming out of that.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And it seems like people both rank it high in terms of importance, access and sort of to primary medical care, and the quality of that is important as well.
Yes.
And I think sort of if there's a way to sort of highlight that and I don't know how this would come across, but the quality of the interaction matters.
Yes, got it. Yeah,
I guess
no,
that's
that makes sense. I think it's a strong conclusion, for sure. And not so much a recommendation, but certainly a strong conclusion. I think that's definitely, it's important to it's important to note that, right?
No, because secondly, and sorry, because I'm sort of spitballing as we go, because a part of the thing that came out as well is that people who are aging with HIV, some of the excellent quotes in there, I wasn't planning on staying living this long. I didn't really I sort of take it day by day. I'm trying to do my best and whatnot. It sounds like, one of the core relationships of many, is sort of, consistent access to, a person who knows you, who, is sort of, in your corner in a way, and that in and of itself is valuable.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Again, an important conclusion. I'm not sure I see a recommendation in that, as far as, because the recommendations obviously are where we're seeing gaps. And if we're not seeing a gap here, I'm not sure if Kira actually felt like she was hearing that there was a gap, that we had medical provide, I saw some fears, but were there gaps as far as the ability to for providers to actually provide this kind of care that Anna and Jan and the, actually the needs assessment are all describing. Kira, did you feel like participants, or Kira and Kat, do either of you feel like the participants felt there were gaps in primary care practitioners actually having that ability to give them that kind of support and have those kinds of quality conversations or is that something that actually is a hallmark of our system, despite the switch over to more gerontology model rather than HIV?
Yeah, I felt that was one of, I was actually pleasantly surprised to hear that time and time again, that folks,
okay.
Yeah, it was.
So I guess no recommendation needed then, perhaps. Like, that's something that the system is doing right. Okay, so that's actually a good conclusion. I would throw in, I mean, you might have listened to the recording again, but I would throw in what Anna and, so, and what Jan mentioned as far as like what we're doing right as a conclusion. I think that's super important. I want to eventually get over to mental health as well. I want to hear from Kat and Kira about that. But before, it looks like there's lots of questions. I saw a TJ, a Helen. Wasn't there another person too? Well, anyway, let's start with the.
It was Mark, Thomas, but he has
jumped. As well.
I think I saw Thomas as well. Okay, so let's start with. We haven't heard from you.
Could you also add me as well?
Yeah, I got it. Let's start with you, Helen.
You know, I thought I heard in Kira's presentation about primary care a comment about revolving door. Is that one of the gaps that patients felt like they were in a revolving door? What was that comment?
It seemed like that was a comment about like they're constantly having new diagnoses. So like they're I'm sorry, Kira, you should answer that question, not me.
So the revolving door comment was more the time of their appointment. It wasn't necessarily quality, but more so the quantity of their appointment. Folks felt like they were really, sometimes when they went to go see their doctors, they were coming in the door, they were getting their needs addressed, but then they were shot right back out. So it wasn't necessarily as in-depth of an appointment as folks would want to see.
Understood.
So was that phrase revolving door a phrase from you or from the actually like a client quote?
That was a phrase from me.
I think I might shift that, because a lot of times when I'm hearing revolving door, I'm hearing repetition. So they're coming in again and again and again. So when I read that landed to me as if it was because, you know, there's so many comorbidities associated with aging and so many different new things that come up. Like they're coming in an appointment after appointment, like they come in, they deal with something, they come back, they leave, they come back with something new. That's what I hear when I see revolving door. So I think you might want to phrase that in a different way. Like if they are feeling like their experience is actually a lower quality at times, which is sort of counterintuitive based on like what we just heard about, they're getting high quality conversations. But we know that doctors have a certain time frames they're actually supposed to process clients. And so maybe just a different phrase in revolving door, but something that signifies like they are feeling, I don't know, managed very quickly, or like they're
feeling rushed.
They're feeling rushed. Yes, actually, simple as that. They're feeling rushed. Appointments have felt rushed, I think, would be a good way to just convey that. So straightforward.
Okay.
TJ?
Yeah, so Mark, I kind of took it a little bit differently. I thought when I heard the revolving door thing, I was thinking about how, and I'm not saying this anything bad about AHP, but you know how AHP's model is they have new interns every year, and along with mental health, they have to cycle through people. So I know through Han and some other organizations I'm part of that I still hear people complaining, like they don't want to go to AHP because it takes 6 months for them to educate the provider, and then that provider leaves when their internship's over. And I feel like I remember this being a pretty consistent thing about mental health. You know, that and the comments about limited number of sessions that they can have. You know, like Kaiser, you can only have 4 sessions. I think with behavioral health, you can have 20 or something. I don't know. It may have changed. But I just feel like, at least over the last 10 years, we need to figure something out to expand mental health services. It's something that always comes up through almost every presentation. And then the thing about the provider, I'm wondering if that's because some of these people who say that they only get out once a week or maybe not get out at all, you know, people build a friendship when they have a professional relationship and they don't realize it, you know, and that might be their only social, you know, social interaction for the week. So that's why they might be feeling rushed too.
Yeah,
I still see clients that on the street from a program I did 10 years ago, and they still think of me and somewhat as a friend and a and also a source of information for referrals still. So
Thank you, TJ. I want to jump in and say we do only have 7 minutes left, and I wanted to hear from Kat and Kira about if there's anything actually around mental health. Certainly, TJ mentioned something, but I didn't actually see what TJ mentioned within this presentation. But Kat, Kira, you both were there. What did you hear as far as specifics around mental health?
yeah, I think what TJ kind of highlighted was straightforward. It was directly brought up, appointment allotments. Folks were kind of having difficulty with that because they did establish a line of care with a mental health care professional, and then they only were allotted six or five appointments. And so once those ran out, then they were just kind of left to figure it out. And then along with wait lists, having to wait a couple of months in order to see a mental health care provider, it was another big issue that was brought up. As well as, I think TJ mentioned this too, was a turnaround of staff. So getting acclimated with one mental health care professional, and then they left, and so now they have to get reacclimated with somebody else.
Yeah. Okay, great. Not so much great as in great. That's great. That's happening, but that actually just might. We want to form a conclusion. I guess based around what TJ mentioned and what you just sort of re-highlighted is that that's a, that is definitely a concern. Kat, did you have anything additional around mental health?
Yeah, so something that came up a lot was a conversation around survivor's guilt. Quite a few participants spoke to that and to the trauma that it brings up, and that they don't feel that the trauma is being addressed in mental health care. I was also wondering if there was a way to make a recommendation around this somehow to ensure that maybe mental health care clinicians are well versed in trauma work, or to allocate funding to getting clinicians trained in trauma work to help address some of this.
All right, that could be something that we can consider. If you could take note, Kira. We're gonna come up with conclusions and recommendations, and then we're gonna actually pass them by the community engagement committee again versus via email. So it won't be, this isn't the end of the conversation. In the interest of time, we have Bill and Thomas, and then I'm hoping that people aren't gonna mind going perhaps 5 minutes over. I don't think we'll be spending a long time on the allocation scenarios, but just in case. Anyway, Bill.
Yeah, hi, Mark. I'll try and go quick. First, I think it's an excellent, excellent presentation. I think there's lots of ways, particularly if it was in a format that's marketable, kind of short of detailing, which Anna mentions, there's a lot of ways to push out that message. And if you want to make that as a recommendation, that some of the findings that HIV Health Services looks for ways to communicate that to a larger audience, I think that's
Oh,
something we
great.
should look at.
Yeah.
The second thing is just that I think the trauma piece is the other pieces there are not. I mean, I've heard the stuff about the trauma, but I don't necessarily know a lot of time and thinking has gone into it. And I actually would want to drill down more if it's survivor trauma or survivor guilt or both. So I think that's probably a second recommendation there. Some of this other stuff we've talked about, we've kind of like in terms of increasing the mental health stuff, I think that could be a long conversation, but it's been tried for a lot of years. But the piece that's just starting to emerge is increased opportunities for socialization that aren't with a one-on-one with a therapist long term for individual, but other sorts of modalities. So if you think that would be responsive to the issues raised there, that is something that's certainly more affordable and more doable, unless we don't want to start cutting other kinds of
I'm
things.
sorry, Bill. Can you say that again? Actually, I think I lost a thread of that as well. I'm not sure.
Sure. Yes. So the recommendation there, Mark, about the need for more individual and more long-term or very long-term individual therapy. You all know that's a very expensive thing. It's probably about $180,000 for about 20 clients. So that's about what it costs to hire a therapist to do that. Or maybe more, maybe 30 clients. So just the sustainability of that, unless the council wanted to defund other things or try and get general fund, which I think would be a tough sell at this point. However, There is a lot of stuff around socialization, which is not just individual therapy. In fact, you know, I think a good number of people might argue people don't necessarily need long-term therapy for the isolation piece. They need to be brought in together and socialized.
Yeah.
So if that feels truthful to kind of what folks are sharing, there's other ways to do that. And now that we really are much more post-COVID, I also think you guys should highlight the fact that this is a 65 plus study. And to the extent there's any differences in the older, like 65 to 75 and 75 to 85 or beyond, if you guys noticed any kind of differences for people within that group, there's a lot of different phases of life between 65 and death. So, you know, if there's a way to tease some of that out, I think that would also be information that would be helpful for us to kind of actualize. So those are my thoughts. Thanks.
Thank you. Okay, so let me just try to summarize what Bill and other folks have said so that we can bring this to a close. I heard two kinds of conclusions. One of them, really a conclusion around how well we're doing in primary care, and how it's important to recognize the fact that like relationships are being created and they're involving like all the good mechanisms of like motivational interviewing and active listening, et cetera. So something about a conclusion about that. And then maybe a conclusion around the challenges around receiving mental health, sort of similar to what TJ was saying around the potential of the high turnover, small amounts of time, and the fact that like many of our clients are dealing with trauma. I guess as far as recommendations go, I love Bill's idea of asking HHS to export this and share this with providers, 100%. And then maybe a recommendation around alternatives to reducing social isolation. Obviously, we have that in some forms of mental health support, but actually it's primarily under psychosocial support, but just exploring the idea of how the care continuum can better support these increasing mental health needs, as well as a recommendation that Kat sort of mentioned around just making sure that trauma is considered like a central part of the potential sort of therapeutic array. That might just end up being two recommendations and two conclusions, if that makes sense. I think I captured it all. And it looks like there's another chat question in here. Italicized would be great. So hopefully I captured that. If I didn't, please someone jump in and correct me. And with that, if you don't mind, Chuck, I'm going to just jump right in because I recognize we are over time and we still have to do a very important thing.
Go for it.
Resource allocation, and also just forgive my talking so much. Gosh, really a cross that I bear. Okay, so this is a motion on the floor. Does not need to be moved and seconded. It's actually three motions on the floor. They don't need to be moved and seconded. They are coming from the Community Engagement Committee. These are our allocation scenarios for all the three potentials of our next funding award. So in the case of increased funding, we have a scenario. In the case of flat funding, we have a scenario. And in the case of decreased funding, we have a scenario. So let me go over them, and then we'll do separate roll call votes. Actually, we'll open up for discussion, and then do separate roll call votes for all. Okay, increased funding, an unlikely but scenario, but has occurred in the past. The scenario on the floor is, if increased funding occurs, service category resource allocation will be increased proportionately across all service categories not covered under California's essential health benefits package. So for those who are new to the council, this might seem perhaps a rather opaque scenario and one that requires explaining. Here's the explanation. There are a range of services that are within our Ryan White service categories that have alternate ways to be reimbursed. And those are those particular service categories that are under California's essential health benefits package. Their asterisks at the bottom, their primary medical care, their mental health services, their pharmaceuticals, their medical case management, their substance abuse counseling, and their dental/oral health care. So the logic behind this increased funding scenario is actually to parallel the decreased funding scenario. You'll see here the decrease was to actually decrease based on starting the first level of decrease to be applied to those categories that could actually find reimbursement elsewhere if there was a reductions that had to happen. So because that was the decreased funding scenario, the increased funding scenario decided to parallel that by saying if there's an increase, it will actually be proportionally across all those service categories that cannot receive additional funding or alternate funding via California's Essential Health Benefits Package. The logic hopefully is less opaque now, although it is no less complex. So this is a motion on the floor coming from community engagement. A discussion of this motion on the floor for the unlikely but occasional chance of increased funding. Okay, wow, no discussion. Maybe people are tired, or maybe I explained it so well. So this is a roll call vote, so I'll be calling on all of you to say yes, no, or abstain. Anna.
I just don't feel I have enough information for me. This is so new to me. I don't know if I just need more discussion, more people to kind of vote on this for me to know.
We can come back if you want to follow.
Okay. Yeah, I can.
How the, like how the group goes. That's perfectly fine.
Okay.
Chuck.
Yes.
TJ.
Yes.
Helen.
Yes.
Irma.
Yes.
Elise. Sorry, you're muted.
Sorry, I usually use Teams, so I'm a little bit dumb on here. Yes.
Jan.
Yes.
And Anna.
Yes, I chose
okay. Trump. Now for the statistically unlikely flat funding scenario. If we receive the exact
sorry,
same
Mark, I don't know if you called me or if I.
Oh, nah. Oh, my gosh.
I'm a yes.
Cannot believe I overlooked nah of all people. My gosh. Please forgive me now. Thank you. Flat funding. It's quite straightforward. If funding remains at the current level, service category resource allocation will also remain level across all service categories. Any discussion? It's a fairly straightforward motion. All right. Na.
Yes.
Irma.
Yes.
Helen.
Yes.
Jan.
Yes.
Elise.
Yes.
TJ.
Yes.
Anna.
Yes.
And Chuck.
Yes.
Thank you. Apologize for having to do a roll call vote, but anything involving money needs to actually have a roll call vote. So sorry about that. And finally, we go to our most likely scenario, decreased funding. So I've already in some ways gone over this in the first scenario. So in the event of decreased funding, for the first 10% of reductions, allocation for services that are covered under California's Essential Health Benefits Package will be reduced proportionally. If further reduced allocation is required, reductions will occur proportionally across all service categories. So as you'll see here, there is an asterisk that actually specifically notes those categories that will be impacted. So again, if there's a cut of up to 10%, then it will go to those that can receive reimbursement through other funding streams since they are part of California's Essential Health Benefits Package. If the cut is somehow over 10%, the motion says that the pain will be shared proportionally across all service categories, and no service category will be spared at that point. So that is the motion before you. Discussion of the decreased funding scenario. Okay, seeing no discussion, let's go right to a vote.
Mark, sorry, if I could just make one comment. As we understand the decreased funding, the first 10% goes to the essential benefits, all the core services. And then anything beyond that, up to 15%, so from 11 to 15% gets absorbed across the board proportionally. So just to make sure everyone's clear of that. So it's not like if it goes to 11%, all the services take an 11 proportional hit. It's that 11 to the 15. And then if it's more than 15%, that we'd have to come back together and come up with another scenario.
Yes to that first part, but to the second part, it actually doesn't specify
reconvening. Oh, you're right. This one doesn't. You're right. Yeah. In the past,
yes, we did. But that's a very solid point as far as that first one goes.
Yes. People should. Yeah. Okay. So you guys want to keep this? You know, there's nothing preventing revisiting. The only thing I'll add is John is actually going back to see his family in England. So if anyone wants something radically different, we haven't done this in years, but we'll have limited capacity to start modeling other kinds of scenarios the day of the event. So if you are thinking of other kinds of scenarios, if you can not wait to the event to pull them up, because it's very hard for Beth and I to try and in that moment jiggle and
of course. I mean, that's part of why we do this all in advance.
Yes. Yes, but back in the old days, Mark, remember people used to bring other alternate proposals to the floor. So
I don't like remembering those old days. They no longer exist for me. The past is gone.
Okay. I'm gonna
let's not visit it, Bill.
Yes, sir.
All right. So we have our current, quite modern 2025 scenario for decreased funding right here. Any discussions on the floor? Does not need to be moved or seconded. All right. No discussion. We'll go with Chuck first. Chuck?
Yes.
Elise?
Yes.
Irma?
Yes.
Na?
Yes.
Anna?
Yes.
TJ?
Yes.
Jan?
Yes.
Helen?
Yes.
Yes, everyone. All right. Thank you all. This will now go to membership, and then it will be traveling on to steering and finally should reappear before you Monday, September 22nd. It might potentially be changed to membership or steering. In that case, you'll see the changed version. And done.
All right. So with that, I think we're finished. So the next meeting will be on October 14th. From 3 to 4 p.m., 4:30 p.m. So we'll see everybody then, okay? All right, bye
everyone. Well,
thanks, Mark, for doing everything.
Everybody.
Kat, Kira, can you stay on?
Thank you, bye.